As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Good morning, everyone. Tom Keene here in New York. We say good morning on economics, finance, investment, on politics, international relations. Joining me this morning, Barry Ritholtz, out with his 10 finance books worth reading this winter.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. 10 books that you have out. Was it hard to put it together?
The difficulty is cutting it down from thousands.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, I do this every winter and every summer, we put out a list of 10 books. What's different about this list is instead of telling you, hey, these are 10 books that are just coming out.
You go back.
I looked at my purchased book to read book ratio, the P to R ratio. Which is actually somewhere in the low twos. Yeah. It's a very disappointing number.
Yeah.
We all have bookshelves at home filled with books that we had every intention of reading.
But we don't.
But let's be honest. Nobody read A Brief History of Time. It may be the most sold book in history, completely unread. In finance, there are lots of books like that.
Okay.
So I picked 10, and I think they're a fun collection.
Good. We'll talk about that through the morning. Barry Ritholtz with us, writing for Bloomberg View and Smart Stuff. Tons to talk about. We'll talk to Mr. Ritholtz solo here later in the hour. Conrad de Quadros with us. This is the patient Conrad de Quadros, who had to put up with a really interesting panel in Frankfurt, Germany. You were very patient on television, as Chair Yellen elbowed you out of the way, and then Governor Carney elbowed you out of the way. And then Mr. Draghi, who has the biggest challenge in 2018 of, let's presume, Powell, Draghi, Carney, Kuroda? Who's got the toughest road ahead?
Well, I would think that the toughest road, actually, I'm going to pick two people. I think that Carney is going to have a tough road because right now they have inflation that's above their target at 3%. They have the expectation that inflation will slow, but a lot of that is seems to be kind of out of their hands. A big part of their expectation for slowing inflation is the improvement in the value of the pound. But of course, that is being driven by political events in, the UK. It's been driven by Brexit. And with some of the difficulties of Theresa May, we've seen the pound take a dip down. So, you know, it's some of the movements in the pound are kind of out of his hands, and yet he needs that to get the slowing in inflation.
Who else?
And then for Draghi, his issue is that, you know, they have this expectation of a small slowing in inflation.
Right.
And based on that, they have the expectation that they'll be buying another €270 billion of bonds next year. But, you know, that inflation outlook is obviously quite uncertain, so they could be challenged by it.
The great acclaim of Conrad de Quadros and John Riding, framed by you guys at Bear Stearns, was the putting green. Does Janet Yellen have any clue on the fairway where the putting green is? To go back to your historic image?
You know, the putting green analogy we came up with back in the mid-2000s when we first started with the discussions of gradualism and why the Fed thought that that was a good idea. And we argued that that wasn't a good idea. Gradualism is like when you take the putter out, but we were still standing, back on the tee box. And that's something that's kind of morphed into, in I think, something even worse now, where I don't even know if there's a golf analogy anymore for how slow the Fed has been going. So But, you know, the fact is there hasn't been, as they've correctly pointed out, there hasn't been any bad outcomes yet. But the problem is we don't know what's going to happen going forward.
Barry, do you play golf?
I do not.
I don't either.
I have a busy schedule that allows some indulgences. I would rather be on a tennis court than a golf.
So you could
work up a sweat. You really don't work up a sweat other than carrying a bag with golf. And those carts are so underpowered. They really need a little more horsepower.
Yeah. Okay.
So I have a question for our guest about what's happening with the Federal Reserve. I keep seeing a lot of pushback to the gradual pace of normalizing rates in that the Fed is behind the curve. And you could see this because the yield curve is now flattening and it's problematic and blah, blah, blah. Do you buy into any of those "the Fed is ruining us" sort of arguments?
You know, on the yield curve, which I think is a great question, it's obviously something that people are very focused on right now. We're not yet at levels on the yield curve in terms of the flatness of the yield curve where we need to be worried about a downturn in the economy. But at the same time, I think it's an important indicator, as I think it is. The other issue is that we have a yield curve that's being influenced both at the front end and at the back end by policies. So what kind of message is it delivering? Like if we look back at when we had the Treasury-Fed Accord, which is the last time in which there was an explicit action on the part of the central bank to target both the front end and the back end of the yield curve, it wasn't particularly instructive back then either. We went into recession when the yield curve was at 200 basis points. So right now, you know, if the Fed wanted to steepen the yield curve, they could do that quite easily. They could just communicate that they're not going to do much on the front end of the curve, but they're going to accelerate the wind down of the balance sheet. That would steepen the yield curve. Would that be something that's necessarily good for the economy? I'm not sure that we can make that case. So the yield curve, I think, is going to be important. You know, if we would get down to flat or inverted yield curve, I'd be a little bit more concerned. But right now, I'm not, given the fact that although it's narrowed, we still have a relatively steep yield curve.
I mean, isn't that the nature of a Fed tightening cycle, that the curve should flatten somewhat?
It does, and it should. But at the same time, I guess the question is that it's flattening. The extent to which it's flattening on such a gradual pace of rate hikes, and I think that's where people are becoming a little concerned.
Do the models work? And I'm talking about basic macro 101, ISLM. Paul Krugman had a brilliant essay on his wheelhouse skill, which is international economics. Do the models we have work, or are we so international, so global in our flows and the speed of transfer of money, goods, and services, that the old models don't work?
You know, that's where I think a lot of central bankers are beginning to question. They're questioning their models, and particularly related to inflation, and that their models told them that inflation would have picked up by more than it did.
But we're so international, like in our labor economy, that we're not getting the wage growth we'd get.
I think that's critical, because obviously I think most people would agree that globalization and the extent to which global value chains have increased, that's something that's been a dampening factor on inflation. Technology has been a dampening factor on inflation. But, you know, we've talked about before the Phillips curve and the way the Fed looks at that. There's really nothing that's, if you look at the Phillips curve, particularly the Phillips curve for prime working age people, the Phillips curve still looks very similar to it has in the past. So my expectation is that we are going to see some pickup in wage growth. The Fed will start to doubt its inflation models a little bit less. And that's not necessarily because that those wages are going to feed through into higher inflation. We also have a lot of other things going on. I think the general view is that Powell as Fed chair is going to just be a continuation of Yellen. But there's one area where that's not the case, and I think that's on regulation. We've already started to see some moves there. So, you know, that's another issue. The breakdown in the credit multiplier, I think, has something to do with regulation, and that's something that's beginning to shift.
So we've seen a lot of tightening on the credit side post-credit crisis. The pendulum has swung from, if you can fog a mirror, you get a mortgage, to we're going to make everybody jump through the most ridiculous hoops. How much of that comes from the Fed? How much of that comes from Graham Dodd? And how much of that is coming just from the banks overreacting the way they did previously?
I think it's a common end. I'd have a hard time quantifying each of those, but I think they're all important. We know that one area that's changing is on regulation. It's not just the Fed. But you know, for example, I think you could look at regulations and say that it was somewhat heavy-handed as it relates to smaller banks, and that's something that's already begun to change. Now, the numbers that are being discussed with this shift in the size of a bank that faces regulation by the federal oversight by the Fed could reduce the number of banks from 40 to 12. So there is some shifts, I think, happening on that front. And the heavy-handedness of regulation, that pendulum has begun to swing a bit in the other direction.
Barry Ritholtz with me this morning. And if you're sort of waking up and going, okay, what's the price of all that's going on in Washington? This is the most important half hour of the day. This is the most important interview of the day. He is, without question, our advisor on fiscal affairs. Stan Collender, in the trenches for years of Capitol Hill. Years ago, he did a Manhattan phone book of analysis on the dynamics of the budget. And now we just want to know, Stan Collender, the view from 60,000 feet. How much will the deficit expand over the next decade, given all the tax cut reform love on Capitol Hill?
Well, if you look at the analysis put out by the University of Pennsylvania yesterday, it said anywhere from $1.5 to $2 trillion over the next 10 years. That's pretty consistent with a variety of other analyses that have come out. The only way you don't get there, the only way you do what Steve Mnuchin said. And said it's going to pay for itself is with growth that would be virtually unprecedented. I mean, even Barry hasn't seen growth that level over that period of time.
Can good politicians on Capitol Hill, desirous of getting reelected, can they go with Mr. Mnuchin on the leap of faith of economic growth?
Oh, sure. Look, this tax bill has nothing to do with the economy. It's not as if the economy needs stimulus right now. In fact, it probably almost certainly doesn't. This is a tax bill that's not economic in origin. It's totally political. So the president and Republicans can say we did what we promised we would do. This is the Trump family tax and family and friends tax cut. This is going to not help the voters who voted for Trump, but help the rich and some of the Trump families.
I mean, Barry, that's the first time I've heard that. Stan, to be clear here, as Barry jumps
in, I don't believe that.
You're calling this the Trump family and friends tax cut.
I am, yes, indeed.
Okay.
So, Stan, we have one version that comes out of the House that's fairly aggressive, and then something that I think it's safe to say is a little more realistic out of the Senate. What's the final version of this going to look like? If you had to pick a number, 20% corporate tax rate, 25%, the LLC pass-through, what do you see really coming out of this when all is said and done?
Yeah, well, first of all, I have a question of whether or not what the Senate passes will be acceptable to the House. Ultimately, it probably will be. Because they're so desperate to get something, anything.
Why is that? Is that just we want to win and we don't care what it looks like, or?
Well, we promised everybody we would do it. We don't want to get the president's tweets criticizing us for not doing it. We want to reward our contributors and encourage them to contribute more for the next election. Again, this has nothing to do with the economy. I think everybody I hear on Bloomberg tells me that it's not going to produce the level of growth that the administration is claiming. And it's not like the Fed requires stimulus. In fact, it's probably going to result in higher interest rates. But to get to your basic question, I think what comes out of the Senate is more likely to be what we see as a final version. And that's a problem for the House members from New York, New Jersey, California, Republican House members, because of the high, because of the Senate tax bill does away with the deduction for state and local taxes. So, I would still give this a 50-50 chance of passing by the end of the year. But if it doesn't pass by the end of the year, the chances of it passing at all go down pretty precipitously.
So the realtors groups have all been screaming about the changes to the mortgage deduction. And even the NFIB, which is about as pro-business a group and pro-tax cut a group as you're going to find, came out and opposed the House version, saying the S-Corp and LLC adjustments exempt far too many small businesses so that they can't support it. How is the pushback from lobbyists affecting what the final version is going to end up looking like?
Well, the answer is not much yet. And I want to emphasize the word yet. The longer this bill sits out there, the longer it takes for them to debate it and to vote on it, the more likely it is, or the less likely it is, that it's going to pass. That's because all the groups you mentioned, plus others, are going to be able to try to communicate to their members well, how bad this is for them. You know, one of the big problems with this bill is that for the average person is that it's being debated so quickly that they don't know what's in it.
Yeah. We have so much to talk about. We're going to come back with Mr. Colander at the Budget Guy out on Twitter. And we're going to talk to Stan Colander about some of the ideas here peripheral to the tax reform slash cut. I want to talk about this idea of analysis of the federal bracket as compared to the all-in tax bill that Tom Keene has versus John Tucker. Because, John Tucker, you enjoy property taxes in New Jersey.
Oh, and you know what I get for that?
What do you get for it?
Close your eyes. Okay. What do you see?
Well, you get a tax deduction, though.
I had a tax deduction.
He had one, as they say. We'll come back with Stan Colander on your all-in tax. This is Bloomberg. We're going to get back to Stan Colander, but very quickly, a World Cup update around his incredibly busy schedule here at Bloomberg. John Farrow, you come from the Midlands of Coventry. Coventry was relegated like in the EFL, and there's like the up-down oddities of English soccer. How bad is Coventry this year? Are they worse than the Italians?
Coventry are pretty bad once again, to the extent that we don't even talk about it in my town, which is about 10 minutes away from Coventry. But I always had the blessing, Tom, that my father was Italian, so I didn't have to support the English teams and I could focus on Italy. And that used to be a good thing.
Why is Italy World Cup football different than what we see in Premier League?
It's national teams only. That makes the massive difference. Yeah. It's not club
football.
What's
a cultural difference in the game?
The cultural difference is that they play the same game, but Italy wins a whole lot more in terms of the English national team versus Italy. Italy have won 4 World Cups, 6 finals, and they've been in every single World Cup since 1958.
How did this happen?
Until next year.
They did even... Well, the news, Rich, everyone knows the news. Italy's not going to the World Cup. How did this happen? How did Sweden dominate this?
I don't know, and I still sit here scratching my head. I'm mourning today.
Did you stop drinking from last night?
I stopped drinking pretty early on when I
saw the result. You had to go back on air. I understand.
And then I had to come on TV this morning. And Barry, it's been a tough day.
Barry, please jump in here with Mr.
Farrell. So when we have a huge upset in either football or basketball in the U.S., it's often things like injuries, a bad officiating call, some extraneous event that leads the statistics to go off the rails. Nothing like that in this, just a better team beat them?
I will say a very ugly conversation is going to start to evolve in the coming days, and it's going to revolve around how many foreigners play in the Italian domestic football club league.
So what does that mean?
What it means is if more foreigners play competitive football in your domestic league, it means that as the youth comes up, the Italians, the young players, don't get the opportunities in a first team to play elite football. This is an argument that's often made in various leagues when the national team doesn't do so well. For me, it's going to become ugly because there's an Italian election next year with the populist parties trying to get a foothold with the electorate. And sometimes, in a very dirty way, these kind of arguments can resonate.
So Sweden doesn't have the same issues? The UK doesn't have the same issues with
foreigners
coming in?
The UK has exactly the same issues.
And how they do?
And the underperformance of the England national team over the last several decades, a lot of people have cited that as an issue.
So there is some consistency there.
Is Sheffield United like the arch enemies of Coventry?
No. Aston Villa.
Aston Villa is...
You've got to get your geography right. Sheffield United is northern England and Coventry's in the Midlands. I'm going to leave you with a final point.
Please.
Italy might still be out of the World Cup, but an Italian still rules the world. Forza Mario Draghi.
You're just... John, it's a better
it's all
discussion.
Central
can you tell? This is the magic of Bloomberg Radio. I'm both on Bloomberg Radio and I should be on Bloomberg TV.
What is Draghi's penalty kick percentage? Is he doing
I imagine it's better than the Italian national team, Barry.
Enough. Go back to television. John Farrell, we decided that when we talk soccer, it's better with a British accent. So
no
we got Farrell in here. We're back with Stan Colander, the Budget Guy. Thank you, Stan, for our digression with Mr. Farrell over to Italy World Cup stand, dead serious on the budget. Holtz-Eakin is better than good. Douglas Holtz-Eakin, taking his PhD under Bernanke at Princeton. He's got a vector, a 5, 6, or 7% deficit to GDP. Do you have a greater confidence in that deterioration of our deficit to GDP because of all this tax cut talk?
No, look, the bottom line is that it's, the deficit to GDP ratio was clearly going up and it's going to go up for 20 years under this plan, unless it's changed.
20 years? Wow, that's a big statement.
Well, remember that all the estimates of the $1.5 to $2 trillion loss in revenue an increase in the debt is only over the first 10 years. Over the second 10 years, it goes up by almost double that.
So are we going to see the same sort of game we saw with the Bush tax cuts of making this quote-unquote temporary by sunsetting after 10 years? Or are these going to be permanent?
No. Some of it, you've already seen some of the gimmicks that they're using. Rosy economic scenarios, dynamic scoring, phases in. And people basically passing it now and saying, we'll worry about the consequences later. I expect that if this passes, it'll be because a lot of people are fooling themselves about economic growth. But let's remember, when Ronald Reagan signed that big tax cut in 81, he then subsequently signed 10 tax increases.
Okay, but there's a major difference here, Stan, and you know the chart I've been using out on Bloomberg, even though you ignore us and never come on air. But the bottom line, Stan, is the debt to GDP was 40% under Reagan, and now I believe it's 100 or just over 100%. Where's the calendar tipping point where that becomes critical to the House and the Senate as they figure out fiscal policy?
All right. You've asked two questions. First of all, when does it become critical? Nobody knows, because we've never quite been in this situation before. In a peacetime budget with the debt-to-deficit ratio and in ratio of GDP to debt being as high as it is, we've never been there. But the real question you asked is, when does it become a tipping point on Capitol Hill? And the answer is not anytime soon. This is a damn the torpedoes, damn the debt, full speed ahead. We're gonna pass this because we want to pass it.
Yeah, but
we promise people to.
But come on, Stan Stiglitz, among others, has a little g for the growth rate of any given economy. When does your world run up against the little g of the U.S. growth economy? Is it like now, or is it our children's now?
No, it's not now. And it could easily be before the 2020 election, but it's more likely to be after, and that's what the politicians are betting on.
So what are the responses from the group of, some people call them deficit hawks, I like to call them deficit chicken hawks, the people who refuse to pass more aggressive infrastructure spending, fiscal stimulus, right in the middle of the financial crisis, which, according to traditional economics, is when you want to see that fiscal stimulus? How have they done a 180 and 10 years later said, now with unemployment in the fours and the economy doing fairly well, now's where we're going to have a big fiscal stimulus?
Yeah.
How do you square that circle?
The deficit hawks, it's not clear they ever existed before. It was always a subterfuge to prevent things happening that they didn't like. But I've written a couple of columns in Forbes that have said that things like the Freedom Caucus are deficit frauds, that the Republicans Party, which has been so deficit hawkish in the past, has shown itself to be uninterested when they're in charge. So let me state this as directly as possible. This essentially is the end of fiscal policymaking in Washington. It's hard to see how we ever go back to reducing the deficit and debt.
This has been great. Stan Colander, valuable. Thank you so much. At the Budget Guy on Twitter. Can't say enough about his work, and we'll have him on much more as we migrate to the end of the year. We got a couple conversations. Alex in London, thank you for your comments on Sheffield and Coventry. He was dazzled by my football knowledge. Good morning, Boston 106.1 FM, Bloomberg 106.1 FM, Boston. La Valley Lumber Company. We've been doing 2x4s at Home Depot.
That are not
Harold works. And Geraldine Lavallee. I think Lavallee. L-A-V-A-L-L-E-Y.
Laval.
I don't know.
I'm going to say
Vermont
like,
and New
like
Hampshire.
Senator Laval. New York State Senator Laval.
Well, Lavallee. It's got a valley in it.
All right, get to the point. What?
It's a great lumber company, I'm told.
Okay.
With guaranteed straight 2x4s.
Straight 2x4s.
Up in the snows of Vermont and New Hampshire. We say good morning.
Well, you would expect that.
We're hearing from lumber companies all around this great nation.
You want straight 2x4s. You can't use a warped 2x4.
Well, I actually have the machinery that will straighten them out.
Really?
I have my techniques.
We are getting into
when
the
in a bind.
Here. Right.
I have a jointer and a planer.
So oh, really? Do you do a lot of woodwork?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
you haven't seen some of my work?
I have a leaf blower, and I will occasionally blow leaves
it's
from
not
the
front
same, walk.
It's not the same thing.
I can do that.
Okay.
I can do that on my own.
That's good.
Can we go to Home Depot?
You're not
want to do a field trip?
Yeah.
There's right some downstairs. Around here. You know, I mean the full Home Depot.
But going with John Tucker is a different experience.
But you have to go to one of the full-size superstores.
That's
and
true.
Not
a
the
suburban
little
kind
appliance,
of thing.
Like the Manhattan.
So I could take Uber out and you and I could do that?
Absolutely.
This is Bloomberg with Barry Ritholtz and John Tucker. Good morning.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
This is a joy. On Emerging Markets, Raji Jain with us with a GQG Partners. And they are in emerging markets. And I believe they have timed the setup. Well, you were with Vontobel and you go over. Did you time perfectly setting up your own shop involving billions of dollars? And like everybody said, okay, Rajiv's out in his zone. Let's have a bull market. Is that how it worked out?
Yeah, well, I think the timing turned out to be reasonable, but obviously nobody knew. I mean, emerging markets coming out of a long bear market. And I think we are still in early stages. If any, compared to Europe and other places.
Let me get, Barry's got a million questions on this. My key one is the emerging markets in the textbooks 10, 20, and 30 years ago, is that still true today, or is it a new dynamic to equity investment in emerging markets?
It's a very different dynamic. I mean, if I go back to the 90s when I started running emerging market funds, I mean, it was much more about export-oriented companies. There wasn't much of domestic economy as such, right? If you go back to the 90s. Now, if you go to the decade after that, in the 2000s, it was much more commodity-driven bull market. Now, today, if you look at it, it's much more technology-driven, and the domestic consumption patterns have also shifted away from what the consumer staples, the Coca-Colas, the Colgates, the Unilevers, away from that into much more of tech consumption. So, which I feel is the new consumer is really driven by that rather than, and obviously, the finance part of it.
You very much anticipated my question, which was going to be a decade or two ago, the strength or weakness of the dollar was perhaps the most important factor for these countries that were so commodity and export dependent. How significant is the strength of the dollar if they're moving away from commodities?
It's a lot less important. So if you look at, Asian trade as such, the dependence on U.S. has gone down dramatically. India was always a lot more domestic economy, but if you look at China itself, their exports overall have not come down despite shifting the low value added stuff to, Vietnam and Bangladesh of this world. So I think it still remains to be seen if there's a massive run in dollar. Which I don't really anticipate, but I think there's a lot more domestic story, not staples, but other domestic stories.
So you mentioned India. We've looked at China as a big driver of the past decade, two decades of not only commodity consumption but manufacturing and export. When is India going to start impacting the global economy similarly to China? I know it's much smaller in terms of landmass. But it's still more than a billion people and much more high-tech and software-driven than China seems to be.
I think if you talk to the commodity companies and their estimates on a go-forward basis, one of the key drivers would be consumption from India because there have been a tremendous amount of reforms that have taken place. Mm-hmm. So while the corporate earnings picture doesn't look that good, I'm pretty bullish in terms of the infrastructure investment that's going to take place. While China is becoming less capital intensive or capital formation is going down, it's not going at the same rate. So I think India would be a key driver from a commodity perspective.
Rajiv Jain with us with GQG Partners. Are alternative investments, hedge funds, long, short, black box, quants, global macro, are they in the emerging markets, or is it just too diffuse for them where they've got to go play in other places?
No, I think it depends on market to market. So if you look at Hong Kong, for example, where there's a lot of the Chinese equities trade, it has much more impact. But a lot of the other markets, the impact is a lot less. So it is not as pervasive as it is probably in the U.S.
So if you're looking at some of these frontier markets, frontier countries, what's the next part of the world that's going to move from really the Wild West, the frontier, into a more developed emerging market country?
Yeah, so I'm kind of a skeptical guy. So mm-hmm. I think most emerging markets would not emerge.
They're not emerging.
They would not emerge. But however, you get these cycles, right? Argentina, I don't know how many times it has emerged and then went back. It was one of the more developed countries in the 1940s, right? It was actually as developed as the U.S. in terms of per capita income and went in reverse for a long time. So it's coming out of, you know, basically a hibernation of 16, 17 years. So you go through these cycles, hard to predict where he's going to have a secular long-term runway.
What about Africa, which is perennially on the verge of seeing some progress and then the same thing, they sort of fall back? Are we going to see any of these countries modernize, become a more significant economy anytime soon?
Yeah, I think on a longer term basis, yes, because if you look at the child mortality and those kind of statistics, they've improved dramatically. So yeah. I'm pretty upbeat on a very long term basis on those areas. Mm.
Rajiv, thank you so much. Rajiv Jain with us with GQG. Please come back. We'd love to have you back in. Particularly, emerging markets, Barry, they've just sprung to life over the last 12 months.
You go through these long cycles where the U.S. outperforms emerging markets for 8, 10, 12 years. Yeah. And in fact, if you look at the gains in the U.S. emerging market, the gap between the two is as big as it's gotten in forever.
How come when Farrow shows up, he gets all the love and emails and tweets and, you know, we get nothing?
I don't know. I can't answer that question.
Thank you to John Taylor.
He has an expertise.
Italian World Cup wisdom. It was just hugely popular. Right now, the voice of William Blair on industrials, and we do want to get to industrials and not just look at General Electric, is Nick Heyman joins us now. Nick, I think everybody knows the story of GE and the debacle down. Organic revenue growth forward, can they surprise, or is it going to be single-digit mediocrity?
Well, that's going to be a key requirement of the new team. You know, we do have certainly probably one of the best global growth GDP outlooks for 2018 since 2012 or maybe even 6. And capital spending has come roaring back. And so you got to make sure you got the sales to lift and benefit from that.
Away from aviation, is there an overcapacity worldwide in the remaining divisions they have? Is it just there's too much power stuff chasing after whatever the available market is?
The power stuff is an issue, you know, as it relates to both the shift to renewables and then geographically the shift from developed to emerging and non-developed countries. And I think this was exacerbated by the fact that there was a egregious pull forward of advanced gas path and other aftermarket service sales in the last 18 months. And so that in turn is a key part of why you now have to suddenly catch up on a restructuring to reduce capacity. Demand peaked in 16, and it was expected to begin to improve in 19, but that is not the expectation now.
So hey, this is Barry Ritholtz. How much of these changes that we're seeing in both the GE revenue distribution and their business focus is not unique to GE, but we're going to see other large industrials have to tack to the, is this the modern world, the changing economy, the digital world? What are the factors for GE that are consistent across the entire sector and not unique to General Electric?
That's a really good question. And we actually sat down and talked about that for an hour this morning in our industrial team. And I think that one of the things that came out yesterday is that GE is stepping back from the oil and gas business and ostensibly from transportation at some point in the future because of their inherent underlying cyclicality. And that in turn makes it hard, no matter how well you worked to run and plan and develop new products and services and analytics for business, makes it hard to be able to take and offset that cyclicality and generate consistent above average returns.
But isn't that the nature of the economy, that some sectors are going to be consistent and some sectors are going to be cyclical? Why would you want to move away from a strong sector that is occasionally cyclical if there are profits to be had there?
No, I mean, quite honestly, that's why we put together things called conglomerates or diversified industrials, so that they, quote unquote, offset those. But I think that, you know, it's pretty clear if you invest, at least at this point, you still make great profits in aviation, unless, you know, the transatmospheric rocket there from, you know, Elon Musk is going to take off tomorrow morning. But in the transportation side, we spend a lot of time focusing on rail, and it's a great market. But it's a great market supplying perhaps safety equipment as opposed to big iron. And in turn, big iron carries with it big fixed costs.
Yeah.
And so they have been extremely successful at predictive analytics for the six class one rails here in North America. But still, even though that's 15% of sales here in 17 and 40% of earnings, they still are looking, I think, to make sure they have the electrified, version of how to move people.
Nick came in with us with William Blair as we tear apart GE. Nick, they've got to sell these companies that they're jettisoning to somebody else under highly visible and bright lights.
Yeah.
What is your experience of, forget about GE, somebody's got to be dumb enough to buy this stuff? Who are those guys?
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question. Right now I would be scratching my head. Who wants to buy Current? You know, the next, sensor-laden, LED commercial lighting.
Take it as an example. What's the price? Who are these people?
It'll be very interesting to see, whether or not, these, quote, next-generation businesses that Jeff and Beth Comstock put together are actually saleable. I would tell you, for instance, though, there are some assets like the joint venture to develop the integrated avionics suite for the COMAC C919, that GE has with AVIC, 50% of that. That could be extremely valuable to Boeing, who wants to get in the avionics business but can't possibly buy Rockwell Collins.
That's interesting.
So there's things like that that you could pull out of a hat, which only drain cash, burn up working capital, and have horrible return. I asked yesterday, John, what is the net collective free cash from all the assets you're thinking about selling? And he said, virtually none.
Really?
Yeah, this is a huge deal. You got to move this stuff.
So how significant are the regulators and the antitrust rules on narrowing the list of potential buyers for these different divisions? Would the Boeing avionics segment actually fly?
It doesn't even in commercial service, right?
Right.
So it's the avionics suite for the next largest market for the next 20 years for commercial aviation, which hasn't even hatched.
And there's no problem with it essentially being Boeing and Bombardier and Airbus and...
There's nobody selling anything into the Chinese, domain, aircraft manufacturer COMAC. So if Boeing were to buy, Rockwell Collins,
right,
all the Rockwell Collins avionics that go into, competitors of Boeing's planes would suddenly no longer...
Right.
Be finding a home there. So this is a very unique kind of situation as you look across the different types of businesses. Because transportation, I think, is a merger maybe with a Bombardier Transport. So you have then a complete suite of transit or passenger as well as freight and a much more global, and all the different types of, propulsion systems, fossil or diesel electric or electric. They ran right into that buzzsaw in India.
Nick, 10 seconds. Buy, hold, sell on GE 12 months out. Where are you?
Right now, we're a buy, and we think that as you unlock, you know, the value from these asset sales, it's probably going to be more disposable cash than the combined free cash flow of $16 or $17 billion in 2018 and 2019.
Very good. Nick Heyman, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate. Total class act to come on. Nick Heyman with William Blair. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.